Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny Abdeljabbar. What's up, brother?
What's up, man? How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I cannot complain. So I was thinking, with 1 million downloads, we need to be thinking about who we should be taking seed money from.
Okay. All right. I'm interested. What are you thinking?
So I narrowed it down to either George Soros or Charles Koch.
Okay.
So, do you want to be part of the Open Society Foundations, or do you want to be part of the Coctopus?
Well,
or we can just take money from Pfizer.
The big pharma.
Yeah. Who do you want to tout to?
Who do you want to sell your soul to? The Coctopus sounds funny, but. I know. Admittedly, I'm probably leaning towards the Open Society's foundations.
Be Sounds part of be an maniacal. Antifa.
Yeah, I don't know. Sounds a little less maniacal than the Coctopus.
You know, it's funny. Not everything that they touch is bad. For example, they do fund the Quincy Institute, which I read all the time. Charles Koch and George Soros. So not everything they touch is
bad. The Koch brothers gave a lot of money to the Natural History Museum, and I love that in New York.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They have a whole wing.
It's easy to say, like, I would never take money from like, major donors like that. However, let's just say if someone from who represented Charles Koch or George Soros reached out to us and said, hey, we want to give you $5 million to really invest in this podcast and make it a mainstream show. I'd be like,
it'd be really hard to say no to, but the unfortunate point is that there's always like nobody's just giving you money for the sake of giving you money.
Right? Yeah,
there's
of course.
A reason why they're giving you money. And that's why like media, you know, you always got to be leery about like where the funding for media comes from or what the parent company that owns the media corporation. And that's why it's funny that you'll see sometimes they'll do these disclosures when they're talking about a particular subject that is related to their parent company, you know, and they'll have to like disclose that. And, you know, they might be being objective, but immediately once they say that, it's like, oh, wait, what you're about to say might be bullshit, you know? So in terms of media, that's one thing. But if George Soros or Charles Koch just wants to give me $5 million for no reason, like with no strings attached, hell yeah, I'm taking that shit.
It's interesting, though. If you read like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, all the time you see guys like writing articles about like, oh, we need to invest, like we're way behind the drone technology or we're way behind on the hypersonic missile race. And then you'll look at that person, you'll do a little bit of digging, and then you'll find out that person's a lobbyist for Raytheon.
Exactly.
Like with one Google search. And they don't disclose that at all. It's just like, oh, we need
to
sell.
That's the first part,
It's really crazy. And like when you think about it, the whole – It's kind of crazy when you see like pharmaceutical products advertise on major news networks, because those are the major advertisers for like CNN and Fox News and MSNBC. Because how often are you going to the doctor and then asking for a medication that you saw on TV?
Never.
You have symptoms and your doctor prescribes you a medication. Like, hey, I saw this ad on Rachel Maddow of something that will make me happy and not see aliens when I go to bed. So it's – or maybe it will make me see aliens but make me happy. But yeah, it's weird. And then you'll also see like ads in like the Wall Street Journal for Raytheon. Like what the – who the hell is reading an ad from Raytheon and is like, oh, like I'm going to buy a fucking missile. I'm going to buy a – a missile detection system, or Boeing. Mm-hmm. Like, why is Boeing advertising on the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times?
I have no idea. Maybe so that they can, I mean, they might be just advertising for the sake of you buying their stock, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
They might be advertising perhaps as a recruitment effort, right? Hey, come work for Boeing, right? I'm sure they pay a lot, and I'm sure they have great benefits, you know? But you're right, it does seem kind of weird, you know, that they advertise these things. And back to the pharmaceutical bit, I think it's funny because if you were to go to your doctor and say, I would like X, Y, or Z drug, I feel like that's kind of frowned upon, right? Like, you don't go to your doctor and say, I want this drug, right? Like, I feel like they look at you weird. Like, if I were to go to a doctor and be like,
pill head.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you know, maybe I'm having trouble focusing and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to go to my doctor and ask for like Adderall, right? Because maybe I have ADHD. And I went to my doctor and I said, I think I want Adderall. They're going to be like, you're either selling the shit or you are addicted to it. And they're going to be less likely to want to give it to me, right? They're going to need to run tests and do an evaluation anyway. So I find it very weird that those medical advertisements even exist at all. It's weird.
It's weird in every other commercial. Well, it's funny. Tucker Carlson, the only person that advertised, if you watch an episode of Tucker Carlson, mm-hmm. you have the weirdest fucking advertisers in the world. Michael Lindell basically sponsors that show.
But at least that makes sense because at least that makes sense because he has a consumer product, right? Stupid as that guy is, you know, and I'm sure his pillows are okay at best, right?
I have a MyPillow. It's honestly, it's not my favorite pillow I own.
Well, that's false advertising because he said it would be. So, you know, there it is.
As crazy, as big of a crackhead. Well, I guess he's recovering. Got to give him credit for that, but he's fucking nuts.
He's a nutbag, yeah.
But it's not just Mike Lindell. It's like other real crazy commercials. You just have to watch it. Like, a lot of religious, like kind of cultish commercials are on. It's strange. But the reason why he takes those ads is because no one else advertises on Tucker Carlson.
That's right.
So he's kind of resorted to, or they're resorted to taking a lot of money to just advertise for MyPillow.com.
What does that say about Tucker Carlson in his show, though?
It shows that he's fighting the establishment. That's what it's showing.
Sure.
So, in other words, here's something that I know you're going to be interested in before we jump into the main topic. So, sure. Britney Watch, because we've been covering this. Mm-hmm. And Britney Spears allegedly chased her sister with a knife. That's what Jamie Lynn mm-hmm. Spears is saying. And mm-hmm. we've been advocating for her release for, you know, a better off in like a year or her freedom from her conservatorship or whatever. Right. And well, look what happened. It's been, what, a month? 2 months? Your girl's already wilding out? Or do you think this is bullshit?
No. So first of all, I read the article that you sent. And she's saying that this happened before. This happened prior. Right? That... allegedly Britney Spears had locked her in a room and had a knife, right?
Okay, so it shows that I didn't read the article. I just said, hey, ha, ha, ha.
So, no, you saw the headline and you were like,
I
fuck
saw the
Britney.
Headline and I just sent it to you and I was like, hey, what's going on?
Let's take Danny down a peg. He's on the wrong side of history here. No, according to the article, and by the way, the article is from the U.S. Sun, which is a total tabloid, right? So let's take that with a grain of salt. But allegedly... Jamie Lynn Spears says that she locked her in a room in the past, but it doesn't say when this happened, like how long ago it happened. Was it before the conservatorship? Was it during the conservatorship? Nothing happened. And secondly, you just have to begs the question, like, if this is true, wouldn't you have gone to the police about that? Wouldn't that have been news in the past? I think the fact that things like this, and this is coming out of like interviews that Jamie Lynn is giving because she's writing a memoir, right? And this is allegedly going to be included in the memoir. I think, and this is my personal opinion, I have no evidence for this, but I think that people like Jamie Lynn Spears, as well as the rest of the Spears family and other people who locked Britney up in a conservatorship for 13 years, you know, I think they're all trying to save face. And they're, I mean, you see a lot of it, like they're throwing each other under the bus. They don't want anything to do with each other. I just recently heard that like the mother, whose name eludes me at the moment, Britney Spears' mom unfriended Jamie Lynn, the daughter, and now they're not friends on Instagram anymore. Like, they blocked each other or some shit like that, right? So there's a lot of turmoil going on in the Spears household at the moment, and it all surrounds the fact that Britney's out, and Britney had been very open and vocal about the fact that, like, she's gonna come after them, you know, legally speaking, not with a knife, you know, like, legally speaking, because they did wrong her, you know, and there's so much evidence of that. And I think they are freaking out right now. So they're trying to tell their own narrative and save their own ass. But, you know, that's up to the court to decide. And if this was true and Britney Spears did do that, you know, my question is why weren't the police called? You know, why wasn't a restraining order set up? What's the deal there? And why are you only now talking about it?
Yeah, you think that would have been mentioned in court, right?
Right. It would have been mentioned in court, and I hadn't heard any of that, you know? And you would think that she would have talked about it, you know, during the height of the Free Britney movement, right? To be like, hey, no, she's actually crazy. Look at this one thing that she did to me, you know?
Yeah. That's a fair point.
The fact that it's only coming out now, like, what's your motivation? Why now? Why are you talking about this now? And I don't want to victim blame here. Maybe it did happen. Let's just give her the benefit of the doubt for a moment. Maybe it did happen, right? What's the backstory behind that? I know it doesn't justify.
Maybe she was being a bitch.
Maybe she deserved it. It doesn't justify you getting locked in a room and, like, being threatened with a knife, but I want to know what the whole story is, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's
what did you do to her? You should ask yourself, why did she threaten me with a knife before I start?
That's like telling a rape victim. It's like, well, what were you wearing? You know, like, it's a fucked up way to look at it, but, like, I think the context is important, especially because there's a mountain of evidence that suggests that Jamie Lynn Spears and her father and her mother and literally all the people in her orbit took a lot of advantage and did a lot of wrong things to Britney, you know? So, you know, I need to know the whole story.
But all right. Well, I guess we're still on Team Britney. All right. I guess is that the status?
Yeah.
Okay. We're still on Team Britney. All right. Cool. Let's get to the topic.
Yeah. Henry, what the hell happened in Kazakhstan last week?
So this is a bizarre story, and I think it's worth dedicating some time on. Last week, there were protests throughout the entire country of Kazakhstan that manifested into a giant riot in Almaty, which is Kazakhstan's largest city. And riot's probably too light of a term. It was, I think, the most violent day in Kazakhstan's history since the fall of the Soviet Union. And, you know, there are estimates that around 225 people were killed, including 18 police officers. And three of these police officers were allegedly beheaded. So their heads were cut off. And I think it's safe to say these protests probably, it's probably not the correct term at this point. They seized the airport. Government buildings were burned down. A lot of businesses were looted. There's this really important museum in Almaty. So there's a lot of, like, ancient artifacts from Central Asia. And looters broke into this museum, and they tried to steal this ancient Scythian armor.
Oh, man. Not the Scythian armor.
Imagine, but it's kind of funny, right? Like, they broke into, imagine if there was a giant riot in New York City and someone broke into the Met and tried to steal, like, samurai armor.
And then they ran through the streets rioting in samurai armor.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I would do. If I was rioting, yeah. I would riot. I'm not saying I would ever riot, but that would be something I would loot. If I wasn't a looting frenzy, it would be samurai armor or ancient Scythian armor. So I can kind of see that.
Yeah.
But, you know, something else you'll find interesting is that, so Kazakhstan is the second largest country for Bitcoin mining.
I didn't know that.
There was a government-forced internet shutdown during these riots, and they disrupted a lot of these mining operations.
Oh, well, no wonder my crypto is down.
Yeah, well, I don't know the full reason of why. I don't know if because that was about a week ago at this point. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of crazy that
unrelated.
Yeah. So all around 10,000 people were detained and arrested. You know, the chaos was so out of control that, you know, the state did not have the ability to control the violence. So President Tokayev, he requested help from the CSTO. So that's the Russian-led version of NATO. It includes Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, mainly because Tokayev, apparently he didn't trust the Kazakh services because he recently had replaced a bunch of the commanders. And in response, Putin, he deployed 2,500 Russian-led CSTO troops to Almaty to mainly just secure important facilities there because, you know, like the airport, that was like one of the number one priority. But in addition to that, the Russians lease out a space facility there. That's always been the heart of like the old Soviet space program. And in the Russian press, this was obviously a way bigger deal because it's closer to home. And also Russia and Kazakhstan, you know, they have the largest border on the planet. About 25% of Kazakhstan's population is Russian speaking. So Russia also conducts anti-ballistic missile testing within Kazakhstan. So it's like an important strategic ally and area for them. And, you know, of course, it was part of the Soviet Union for many years. Of course, with the Russians moving in, though, you know, Blinken, Anthony Blinken was like, hey, once the Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave. But, you know, imagine the Secretary of State saying that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah. And, you know, the Russians, I think, are basically, I think the 19th is like their last day to go, but they're, you know, apparently on their way out.
Oh, they have an out date? That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know. So I guess, you know, that's a crazy ass story. And, you know, it begs the question, like, why? Like, how did this all start?
Yeah, so it's real interesting. So on the surface, and it's confusing too, so this is a, you know, a complicated subject. On the surface, it was sparked by a sharp increase in fuel prices, but it developed into a larger protest against the corruption of the oligarchs running the country. And, you know, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, Kazakhstan has been ruled by a strong man named Nursultan Nazarbayev. And, you know, through this period, Kazakhstan experienced, you know, one of the strongest performing economies out of all the, you know, the old Soviet states in Central Asia, with their oil production representing a very large percentage of their economic growth. And Kazakhstan also has 40% of the world's uranium sources. You know, it's funny because I think it's easy to think of Borat when you think of Kazakhstan.
Right.
Like, I've never heard of the country Kazakhstan before the Sasha Baron Cohen character. In the movie, when the movie came out, you know, that nice, like, I'm from Kazakhstan. I had never really heard of that country. This was, what, 15 years ago, almost? Mm-hmm. I was in high school, I think, when this movie came out. So I think a lot of people's impression of Kazakhstan is that it's some kind of backwater, like, where the fuck is this place on the map? Is this actually even a real country, or is this a fictional country made up for the show type of thing?
Yeah, it's not Wakanda. It's real. Yeah.
Yeah.
Me neither, honestly. And I didn't know about Kazakhstan before the movie. And what was so fascinating about this was that when I was doing research for this particular episode, I just noticed how much my opinion of what a Kazakhstani looks like was shaped by Borat. Like, watching these videos and the interviews and things like that, like, they look nothing like Sacha Baron Cohen, which is, I guess, kind of the whole point to the irony of that particular movie. Like, the fact that a comedian can trick stupid Americans into believing whatever, including, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen, you know, a Jewish guy, an Israeli Jewish guy, is what Kazakhstani people look like. And that's what they sound like, you know? I think it just really puts things in perspective, you know?
The opening segment of that movie, I think the movie is hilarious, by the way.
I think it's gold.
Like,
yeah,
I still think the movie is hilarious, but the opening segment when he's in the backwater village and he's, like, making out with his sister, they draw Kazakhstanis as the most, like, depraved backwater people on the planet.
Yep.
He's like, this is village retard. Like he's low IQ. He's in cage.
Right.
Like, it's funny, but you're like, well, you know, in hindsight, it was.
The movie is incredibly offensive, but incredibly funny. Offensive. You know, and I have to, for a moment, just like check myself, because I got. You know, like, I knew the movie was a movie and it was funny, and it, you know, it's funny to see, you know, Borat trick people like fucking, you know, Ron Paul, you know, and shit like that, where he traps him in a room, in a hotel room, and like tries to do something sexual with him. You know, that's funny, because you're like, ah, ha, ha, he got caught. He's gullible, right? But I'm sitting here not understanding the fact that I was gullible, and I still thought that maybe Kazakhstani people look like that or sound like that. I was getting got this whole time, and I didn't even know. Yeah. You know?
Well, something. So the major cities in Kazakhstan, they're highly subsidized.
Right.
So if you look at cities like Almaty and Nur-Sultan, they're beautiful cities. Like Nur-Sultan, the capital, which, you know, recently changed its name, it has like these beautiful cathedrals and mosques everywhere. They have like a lot of landmarks, like they have like this really. This really cool like site tower, I think it's called the Bayterek Tower. They have like a lot of like sick gardens and shit like that. Like, it's a beautiful city. It's kind of like Riyadh, like a subsidized city. But, you know, despite these subsidies, there's a lot of corruption there. You know, there's a handful of families that basically, you know, steal money from the state and their national industries, and then they invest that money into UK real estate, which is like the classic playbook for the, you know, the post-Soviet Union oligarchs. So Nazarbayev, you know, he steps down as president in 2019. His prime minister, Tokayev, he becomes president, but Nazarbayev, he retains power, and he was given the honorary title of leader of the nation.
Yep. And fun fact, I know you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but Tokayev, he changed the name of the capital from Astana to Nur-Sultan, and he named it after Nur-Sultan Nazarbayev. So another little bit. Yeah,
it's important to note that Nazarbayev, he stepped down, but he still has powers. So, you know, he has the father of the nation title. Mm-hmm. And we talked about this like probably when this happened about 2 years ago. It's been mm-hmm. a while since we last talked about this, but when he stepped down, Nazarbayev, he still remained in their security council. He's their security council chairman. So it was supposed to be meant as like a long transition of power where, you know, this guy has been president for 30 years. His name literally was the only name on the ballot for a couple of these elections. You know, he was a strongman dictator. So this was like their attempt at transitioning him out of power. So a lot of people fucking hated him. Like, a lot of people hate Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan, especially in places in the western part of the country where a lot of the petroleum and oil fields and gas fields are located. So the protests started on the 1st of January into the 2nd day of January after there was a decision in the province of, I can't really pronounce it, Mangusau. I think I'm pronouncing that right, Mangusau.
Probably. Mangusau.
Probably. Yeah. All right. Well, forgive me for mispronouncing that. I think it's called Mangusau. And it was after a decision to liberalize the prices of liquefied petroleum gas, which is, you know, the gas that you use to pump your car. So for your car, which effectively doubled the price. So it went from 60 teng per liter, which is 14 cents, to about 28 cents. So it doubled the price in gas, and then it quickly developed into this social and political protest movement. And the protesters, they demanded that the former president, Nazarbayev, be stripped from all of his remaining official duties.
Hold on. So I just did a quick Google search because I'm shit at metric. So you're saying 60 teng is 14 cents, and they were charging that per liter?
Yeah, it was about 50 or 60. I might be a little bit wrong off the conversion, but I think it was about 60 or 50 teng, and it doubled.
Right, to 120. Well, just for context, 1 liter, for us Americans out there who don't know liters, is 0.26 gallons. So that means you multiply the 14 cents by 4, which is, and I can't do math in my head like that, it's 56 cents a gallon. Double that, that's like $1.12 per gallon. So I just want to point out that their gas was fucking cheap in the first place. But of course, they have a much lower GDP than us, so they also make less money. So that's something to think about, but that's incredibly cheap. But you double
it's incredibly cheap for U.S. standards, but they're an oil and gas producing nation.
Right.
So the fact that their price is doubled, and you know the average person in Kazakhstan who's driving a car is not making the same wages.
Of course not. I guess I'm just putting it into context, you know, and saying like, so we produce oil and gas too, right? But, you know, a lot of us here in the States are bitching about high gas prices and blaming Biden about it, right? And in some ways, maybe he's responsible, in some ways, maybe not. But the point is that our gas prices haven't doubled, right? So it's kind of crazy.
Well, you know, I'd rather be bitching about high gas prices than bitching about like making $100 a month.
Yeah. Same. Right. Yeah. We're very privileged. Yeah. Very, very privileged.
Like, if people just make less money.
Right.
You know, they can spend, you know, services cost less in other countries, but usually commodities and finished goods cost a lot more. So, you know, you may be able to get a haircut for a cheaper price in a country that, in a developing country, but you know, buying a finished good or a finished product is like almost impossible. Like a TV, like from Sony, or something like that. Like one, like some kind of a luxury item that we kind of take for granted in the States. You know, you really, they don't really have access to that.
No.
But yeah, I sent you over a Wall Street Journal article that was published on January 6th.
Yep.
January 6th, a day in infamy. On January 6th.
Right.
So,
yeah, I can read
Why don't you go ahead and read that?
For sure. So it reads, although triggered by a sharp rise in fuel prices, the protests in Kazakhstan quickly swelled amid general discontent with the regime that has held power since the fall of the Soviet Union. Demonstrations have taken aim at economic woes and the country's authoritarian political system, which allows for little dissent. Economic protests in recent years took on a more political tone after ex-president Nursultan Nazarbayev left office in 2019 after nearly three decades as leader. He designated Mr. Tokayev, a former prime minister and speaker of the Senate, as a successor while retaining influence as head of the Security Council. Mr. Tokayev renamed the country's capital Nursultan after Mr. Nazarbayev and appointed the ex-president's daughter to the powerful role of Speaker of the Senate. Opposition parties remained largely excluded from political life, protests were often banned, and activist leaders arrested. The Kazakhstan government has repeatedly promised to address high-level corruption in addition to better sharing the wealth of the country's natural resources and overhauling its authoritarian political system. Little has happened. Frequent promises of mass privatization of state assets, touted in the West as a sign of reform, have fallen short. The country's foreign ministry Thursday described attacks on government buildings at the height of the protests as evidence of high-level coordination and planning, pointing to how demonstrators briefly seized the airport and disrupted flights. It proved that the country faced an armed incursion by terrorist groups trained abroad, it said. Russia's foreign ministry concurred, describing the protests as an attempt inspired from outside to undermine the security and the integrity of the state by force, using trained and organized armed formations. It said Russia will continue to consult with Kazakhstan and other allies on how to help Kazakh security forces combat the alleged threat.
So the Russians and Tokayev have been saying that, they've been hinting that the West has been behind this violent uprising. And, you know, my immediate reaction is that it's like, yeah, like it seems absolutely like it's a color, it's some sort of color revolution. And
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So, you know, blogs like Moon of Alabama, and a lot of other, a lot of like anti-war type outlets are, or anti-empire type outlets, you know, they're writing that this was a step in the RAND Corporation's playbook to weaken Russia.
Here we go with the Moon of Alabama conspiracies. Let me hear it.
So, listen, man, I enjoy reading Moon of Alabama. I say it again. I think it's interesting. You know, it is conspiratorial in a lot of the stuff they write. Mm-hmm. So what they write is that, or Bernard, who's like the main blogger there,
right?
He uses this 2019 RAND Corporation published plan for soft attacks on Russia. It's called Extending Russia. And what it does, it lists five ways to weaken Russia, which are, well, I'm going to read them out. So, A, it's provide lethal aid to Ukraine. That is, we did that already. The United States has provided lethal aid to Ukraine. Increase support to the Syrian rebels. You know, they did that up to the Trump, to the Trump. They came up to Trump coming to office. Exploit tensions in the South Caucasus. So I guess if you attribute the war between Azerbaijan and Armenia to the U.S., but I think that's kind of a stretch.
A little bit.
And then reduce Russian influence in Central Asia. So that's like the step that, you know, where the Pentagon is on right now, is reducing Russian influence in Central Asia, meaning countries like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and, you know, these.
All the stands.
Former Soviet satellite states. So this riot was definitely coordinated, like without a doubt. Like it's easy. It started off as a protest, but it was obviously subverted into a very violent, coordinated movement to overthrow the government there, or at the very least cause as much chaos as possible. Now, right now, I don't know how much evidence that the U.S. was involved. I'm not an expert on how these NGOs work, and how they coordinate with intelligence agencies to take over countries. And I don't really know enough about Kazakhstan to really come up with an educated conclusion or hypothesis of what exactly happened. You know, I'm just doing the best I can to take, you know, some of the mainstream sources from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, and then looking at some of the more, more Russian media and European media, and then looking through Twitter to see, you know, what exactly happened, because it's complicated. So I'm still trying to parse that out, and I haven't had time to cross-reference everything I've read to confirm a lot of the noise that's come out. So I just want to be really clear about this as we jump into, you know, some of the accounts that happened during this riot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the same boat with this one. A whole lot of government-sponsored narratives being thrown around, and it's really hard to figure out what's true and what isn't at this point right now.
Yeah.
So, take everything that we read with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and we have, I think we both don't really have that much experience commentating on Central Asia, so it's not like we're any type of authorities. You know, we have a lot more experience commentating on the Middle East than Central Asia. But the RAND Corporation paper that a lot of people are sourcing, I've read this paper and I've sourced it on other episodes. Like I've used this paper as a source from other episodes that we've done in the past, talking about Ukraine mostly. But I don't think this paper amounts to a smoking gun. Because the RAND Corporation writes a lot of crazy stuff. And, you know, a writer of a RAND Corporation paper the other day, he came out and actually wrote an op-ed at, where did he write it? I want to say Financial Times. This guy wrote a paper, an article for Financial Times, and he wrote about it. It's like, hey, let's, we need to just give up on this Ukraine thing. So he was someone who had previously published like a, you know, a, something out of the RAND and the RAND think tank. But the point I'm trying to make is that not everything that the RAND Corporation writes comes true and is like dictated U.S. policy. It's a think tank that's been around for a long time, and they write all mm-hmm. sorts of shit. And like their job is to write like these strategic papers about things that the U.S. could possibly do to get some strategic edge in a geopolitical landscape.
It's kind of like a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah, but you know it is. Like, so. It is compiled. It's part of like the evidence. Like you would use it mm-hmm. in like an entire case. But that one paper enough, I don't think, concludes anything.
Yeah.
And then the paper. Well, if you read the paper too, it also says that the chances of it working, a project like this working, is actually not successful in trying mm-hmm. to pull Kazakhstan away from Russia's orbit. Like the end mm-hmm. conclusion of this says that it won't be successful. Like it most likely will not be successful. If you guys are interested in reading through it. This wasn't like Ukraine in 2014, where there was very clear evidence that the U.S. was involved in throwing Yanukovych. You don't have Robert Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, on tape talking about who she wanted to replace Yanukovych with. Hmm. But to their defense, these roaming gangs seem to be very well trained. So I understand how this is like the immediate reaction or how this pops in your head. The Russians in the government in Kazakhstan, they really seem to think that this was an attempted color revolution. You know, they're calling it a hybrid terrorist attack by the words they used was by both internal and external forces aimed at overthrowing a government. Also, the government of Kazakhstan has always had a pretty strained relationship with the different NGOs in the country that have been, you know, there to promote like, you know, democracy and human rights and things like that. You know, the alleged connection is that NGOs are said to be fronts for the CIA. Now, I had sent you over a piece from an investigative reporter and an analyst named Pepe Escobar. And, you know, Pepe Escobar is definitely a conspiratorial journalist as well. Who I've read him in the past and a lot of things, and I think he does make stretches sometimes, but I know a lot of his experiences in Central Asia. So I sent that over to you, and he kind of paints a picture of how it was most likely it was U.S. and Israeli and Turkish and British sponsored this entire operation.
Yep, I can read through some of that and pull out some of the quotes that we wanted to talk about. So one bit was he writes, when President Tokayev was referring in code to a single center, he meant a so far secret U.S. Turk Israeli military intel operations room based in the southern business hub of Almaty, according to a highly placed Central Asia intel source. Interesting. He also writes, in this center, there were 22 Americans, 16 Turks, and 6 Israelis coordinating sabotage gangs trained in West Asia by the Turks and then ratlined to Almaty. The op started to unravel for good when Kazakh forces, with the help of Russian CSTO intel, retook control of the vandalized Almaty airport, which was supposed to be turned into a hub for receiving foreign military supplies.
Yeah, and then he goes on to say that the Russians had intel on this prior, mm-hmm. and that's why they were so ready to go when this riot started to break out, that they allegedly had intelligence that there were Salafi fighters from Syria in northern Afghanistan ready to be used. So he writes about that, and you know he's basically saying that, you know, there were foreign fighters that were imported into Almaty to escalate the riots into something a lot more deadly.
Okay, well then on that Salafi bit, he writes, the that's the bulk of the ISIS Khorasan or ISIS-K reconstituted near the borders of Turkmenistan. Some of them were duly transported to Kyrgyzstan. From there, it was very easy to cross the border from Bishkek and show up in Almaty. That explains, among other things, a record number of preparation drills conducted in late 2021 at the 210th Russian military base in Tajikistan.
Yeah, and then he goes on to source the RAND Corporation report that, you know, that, that other people have been sourcing.
All right, so he wrote then on that point, every color revolution needs a maximum Trojan horse. In our case, that seems to be the role of the former head of KNB, the National Security Committee, Karim Masimov, now held in prison and charged with treason. Hugely ambitious, Masimov is half Uyghur, and that, in theory, obstructed what he saw as his preordained rise to power. His connections with Turkish intel are not yet fully detailed, unlike his cozy relationship with Joe Biden and son. A former Minister of Internal Affairs and State Security, Lieutenant General Felix Kulov, has weaved a fascinating, tangled web explaining the possibility of internal dynamics of the coup built into the color revolution. According to Kulov, Masimov and Samir Abish, the nephew of the recently ousted Kazakh Security Council chairman Nursultan Nazarbayev, were up to their necks in supervising secret units of, quote, bearded men during their riots. The KNB was directly subordinated to Nazarbayev, who until last week was the chairman of the Security Council.
So that's what that's what we're getting at, and that's what a lot of pretty much a lot of mainstream sources are also painting towards, that it was Nazarbayev's nephew who was coordinating all of this.
Right. Okay, so he goes on. He says, when Tokayev understood the mechanics of coup, he demoted both Masimov and Samat Abish. Then Nazarbayev voluntarily resigned from his, voluntarily resigned from his lifelong chairmanship of the Security Council. Abish then got the post, promoted, promising to stop the bearded men and then to resign. Okay, so a lot of people losing their jobs, potentially not their choice either, but he's moving on. So that would point directly to Nazarbayev-Tokayev clash. It makes sense, as during his 29-year rule, Nazarbayev played a multi-vector game that was too westernized and which did not necessarily benefit Kazakhstan. He adopted British laws, played the pan-Turkic card with Erdogan, and allowed the tsunami of NGOs to promote an Atlanticist agenda. Tokayev is a very smart operator, trained by the foreign services of the former USSR, fluent in Russian and Chinese. He is totally aligned with the Russia-China, which means fully in sync with the master plan of the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, the Eurasia Economic Union, and the SCO. Tokayev, much like Putin and Xi, understand how this BRI, EA, EU, SCU triad represents the ultimate imperial nightmare, and how destabilizing Kazakhstan, a key actor in the triad, would be a mortal coup against the Eurasian integration. Okay, this is making a pretty strong case here. Last couple of bits. He writes, Kazakhstan, after all, represents 60% of Central Asia's GDP, massive oil and gas, and mineral resources, cutting-edge high-tech industries, a secular, unitary, constitutional republic bearing rich cultural heritage. It didn't take long for Tokayev to understand the merits of immediately calling the CSTO to the rescue. Kazakhstan signed the treaty way back in 94. After all, Tokayev was fighting a foreign-led coup against his government.
Well, so the painting that they're trying the painting that they're trying to picture. They're trying to say that Tokayev is more aligned with Russia, Nazarbayev has been too friendly with the West, and that's why there was a coup to that favored Nazarbayev over Tokayev, because he's too on board with the BRI and too close of allies with Russia. I saw Pepe Escobar on the Moderate Rebels podcast the other day. He was on it yesterday with Max Blumenthal, and I usually listen to stuff that Max Blumenthal says. So I don't know. It's interesting. He kind of goes over this article, and it's an interesting case. But even to what I was saying before about mainstream outlets have been kind of mirroring, they have mirrored a lot of this information. The New York Times has had wrote this piece about the power struggle between Tokayev and Nazarbayev. They published an article called "Kazakhstan Street Battles: Signs of Elite Fighting Each Other." I sent that over to you as well.
Yeah, I can read that part too.
Yeah.
In it, they write, Daniil Kislov, a Russian expert on Central Asia who runs Fergana, a news portal focused on the region, speculated that the chaos was the result of a desperate struggle for power between the feuding political clans, namely people loyal to President Tokayev, 68, and those beholden to his 81-year-old predecessor, Nursultan Nazarbayev. At the height of the tumult on Wednesday, the president announced that he had taken over as head of the Security Council, a job held until then by Mr. Nazarbayev, who stepped down as president in 2019 but retained wide powers and was given the honorary title of El Basi, or leader of the nation. So President Tokayev also fired Mr. Nazarbayev's nephew, Samat Abish, as deputy head of the main security service and purged several others close to the former president. The riots in Almaty, Mr. Kislov said, appeared to be an attempt by members of Mr. Nazarbayev's political clan to reverse their eclipse. This was all artificially organized by people who really had power in their hands, he said, adding that Mr. Nazarbayev's ousted nephew seems to have played a major role in organizing the unrest. So it goes on. It says Galim Agilulov, wow, that's a name, Agilulov, a human rights activist in Almaty who took part in what began as a peaceful demonstration on Wednesday, said police officers monitoring the protest suddenly vanished around lunchtime. Then his crowd came, he said, an unruly mob of what seemed more like thugs than the kind of people, students, bookish dissidents, and middle-class malcontents who usually turn out for protests in Kazakhstan. He said the mob was clearly organized by crime group marauders, that was in quotes, and surged down main streets towards Akimat, the city hall, setting cars on fire and storming the government offices. Among those who urged the crowd on was Arman, okay, I'm going to try it, Jumageldiev. I'm going with that.
Call him Borat.
Borat. It goes on. It says he's known as Arman the Wild, so we'll call him that. By the reputation of one of the country's most powerful gangsters, who witnesses say provoked much of the violence. All right, Armand, chill out, bro. He gave a frantic speeches on Almaty's central square as the government buildings blazed behind him, calling for people to press the government and make concessions, and mocking as a coward Mukhtar Ablyazov, an exiled tycoon who is bitter personal enemy of the Kazakhstan's longtime former president, Mr. Nazarbayev. That's fascinating.
Yeah. That's interesting. So I think that, at this point, I think there's kind of enough circumstantial evidence to suggest that, at the very least, that Nazarbayev's cronies were involved in organizing this.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to be the most consequential evidence that I'm getting out of all of these things that we're here, because there is a clear delineation of a shift of power, right? Like Tokayev steps up in 2019. He was the former, Speaker of the Senate and the Security Council guy. And then he takes the presidency. He lets Nursultan chill and, have a little bit of power. If you're on the head of the Security Council. But, he gives him that honorary title so that, people don't shake things up too much. But it seems like in the last couple months or weeks, he's just been kind of cutting out all of the people that were close to Nursultan, right? The rationality behind that is unclear, I think, from everything we've read so far. But, objectively, it looks like all the people inside of Nursultan's orbit are kind of losing their jobs and losing their power. So you know, Occam's razor here, it does feel like this is an internal power struggle, right? Now, the bits about a US, UK, Israeli, Turkish, like, coup attempt, I mean, I can see that as maybe being a possibility, because why wouldn't they take advantage of an internal power struggle? It wouldn't be the first time, right? But I'm not really seeing a ton of evidence about that yet. So I'm like straying away from that, because there seems to be enough evidence to suggest that this is an internal power struggle, you know? So like, why do you need to go there?
Yeah, I'm sort of at that. That's where I'm at too. That it does seem like there's not a lot of evidence that it was something between, ruling clans of the state. But I mean, who knows, man? Like, there might be some more smoking gun evidence to suggest that it was it was coordinated by the West. I don't know if we're ever going to get that, though. I don't think, like, we're not going to get a phone call recording of Victoria Nuland on this, or maybe we will. Just saying, hey, like, here's who we want to replace Tokayev with. We want Nazarbayev back in as president. Like, imagine that.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that
shit
would just be fucking crazy. Or like, we want his nephew as president now, and we don't want we think this guy, like, I don't think we'll probably get that smoking gun type evidence. But let's talk about what also is interesting is that there's a Wikipedia page on this already.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah. Yeah.
I was surprised that a Wikipedia page got out so quickly. It's like so detailed of events that are so unfolding, and it's kind of weird. It begs the question of who's making these Wikipedia entries.
I don't know.
So let's talk about this in more detail, because I think, you know, there's a little bit more color we can add to it to tell the full story. So these protests were apparently peaceful at first, which was kind of reflected in that New York Times article that the initial protesters were like students and middle-class people, bookish people was the word. Yeah. And that's how the protests were in Syria as well when they first started. That's how the protests were in Ukraine as well. When they first started in 2014, it's, you know, students, young people, dissenters, you know, like, there's plenty of protest in the United States that are peaceful. You get kind of a big hodgepodge of people. Now, what happened is that they eventually turned more violent. So the protesters nor the police, they were using any type of lethal force. But on the night of January 4th, Tokayev, he calls a meeting of the country's Security Council, which Nazarbayev usually chairs. And Nazarbayev wasn't present at this meeting. And this is where Tokayev, he announces a state of emergency. And then he also announced that Nazarbayev would no longer be chair of the Security Council. He also capitulates to the price return of gas. So they returned the price of LPG back to what it was. And then he said he was going to announce all these different government reforms. So the following day, apparently, things returned to normal. So we're talking about the morning of January 5th. There were some clashes between protesters and the police officers there, but they were relatively minor. And then they accept the government's resignation. And then the next morning, things were getting just a lot more normal. Now, what happened was that night, somewhere between, and this is the number that I've read, between 10,000 to 20,000 protesters showed up.
So wait, weren't all the demands of the protesters met? Like, didn't they get what they wanted?
Yeah, exactly. That's what this is what makes the story so weird, because after a lot of the demands were made and then Nazarbayev is fired, basically, or resigns voluntarily, as in quotes, as there's changes in the government, as like a lot of the government is beginning to resign, and a lot of things are kind of capitulated to, or at least there's like progress from the protesters, and after there's kind of a cool down, that's when it re-escalates. So that's when a boatload, you know, 10 to 20,000, I know it's like a really large gap in the estimate, but we can just kind of safely say that thousands of new protesters arrived, and these new protesters who arrived, these were started hunt that they started looting, and they started looting hunting shops, and then allegedly they were bringing automatic weapons. There were cars bringing them automatic weapons and iron rods. At this time, the police flees, and then the rioters, they start launching Molotov cocktails at two sides of the city council building. So they surround the city council building. You can look up the city council building. It's burnt down. It's fucking crazy. So they burnt this fucking place down with Molotov cocktails. And then they allegedly went to Nazarbayev's like residence. They set that on fire.
Wait, they set his house on fire? Like his personal house or like the government?
I think it's his personal residence. House they set on fire.
All right, well, now I'm starting to think it's not Nazarbayev, because why the fuck would he burn his house, like have his people burn his own house down?
Or no, not Nazarbayev. I think it was Tokayev's house.
Oh, Tokayev. Okay, yeah. Now I'm back.
Excuse
on
me,
the Nazarbayev.
I got the names wrong.
Now I'm back on the Nazarbayev train.
Yeah. So then they attacked. So then they went to the prosecutor's office. This is where they killed. They took the police there who were guarding the prosecutor there, mm-hmm. and they beheaded them.
So this is ISIS then, right?
I mean, it's definitely a calling card of very, very like hardcore extremists. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. to start cutting people's heads off. I mean, yeah. I honestly don't even know if this is confirmed yet. That I should probably add that you know these allegations that police officers were beheaded. You know, like. Right. On January 6th, there were allegations that protesters beat up, killed a police officer with a fire extinguisher, and that wasn't true. Like, so, you know, that this is a different country. Hmm. That maybe that's not true. Because there's a lot of in-between sources between us and Kazakhstan, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So we're not mm-hmm. going to get the full picture. But that's the story that, you know, the cops there were being... detained. The police officers were detained, and then they were having their heads chopped off. So yeah, maybe ISIS. Like that would definitely be something that a real hardcore crazy fighter would do. And this is, I'm getting a lot of this from Euractiv, which is I think is based out of Brussels. Mm-hmm. And you're right. Among the rioters, there were people from outskirts, but also bearded people, Salafists who are very well organized and came in groups of 25, split into smaller groups of 5. Within these groups, one is a trained militant who commands the other 4. And I translated this via Google Translate, so it's not perfect. These are people with combat experience, good physical fitness, and they succeeded very rapidly in overwhelming law enforcement.
Okay, I got it. It's ISIS. Like what they're describing is ISIS.
It's a network of probably a leftover, a fighter from yeah. from either Syria
it's
or
a,
Afghanistan. Like these are leftover fighters.
I want to know, how do they know that they were Salafists and bearded people? How do they know this? That's what I want to know.
That's a good question. How did they know this?
Do they have pictures?
It might have just been their Arab. Could have just been their Arab. They were like, oh, the Arab guys are walking around, they're ISIS. And then who knows, maybe the story about the heads being chopped off is just theatric, but maybe it's true. Right. But what's also real interesting is that they take over the airport on the night of the 5th. Mm-hmm. So the airport was taken over by allegedly 800 rioters.
Okay.
That's what this article says. And the airport is about 12 kilometers from the city center, and then they were bused there by trucks, and then they apparently were taking drivers and throwing them out of their cars like Grand Theft Auto style.
All right, so I got an interesting theory. So you said that this happened on the night of the 5th to the 6th, right? So January 6th.
Yeah.
Here's my conspiracy theory. This was actually organized by the U.S. right-wingers to make the anniversary of the Jan 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol look like a peaceful protest in comparison. Like, I feel
sure,
like Rachel,
yeah, that's it. That's it. I think you
Rachel Maddow must be saying this right now, I think.
I think you nailed it. I think that's exactly what happened.
That's what happened. That's
the oath breakers or the oath keepers, whatever the hell they're called. They went ahead and they organized this. They organized this.
These
beheadings in Kazakhstan. I think that's a safe theory.
I think that's pretty safe. Some of them had beards. Think about that.
I have the connection.
See, some of them had
just
beards.
I'm just connecting everyone with a beard.
Right. So there it is. That's the story. Anyway, let's get back to the real story.
Okay. So, now, they're saying, the word on the street is that there was no resistance from police at the airport, and then the rioters, they took control of the buildings, and then they took control of the runways. And then I guess this is where the lines are connected of they were going to take over the airports, and they were going to import other Salafi fighters.
Okay. So this isn't what I'm reading about, like, police shooting peaceful protests. So I did read a few articles where it sounded like Kazakhstan's being a total dick right now and shooting peaceful protesters, because it seems like the protesters had guns and were allegedly chopping heads off and shit, right?
So, well, hey, man, I don't know. Maybe there was some police firing on some protesters. Like, I wouldn't be surprised, but what I've been reading is that the aggression was from the protesters first. Like, they weren't fired upon until they attacked police headquarters. And that's when they started firing live rounds at the rioters.
But I wonder,
death toll started to pack up to increase.
Yeah, I wonder about that though, because I did see like a bunch of water cannons and like other, you know, like tear gas and your typical like crowd control shit that police do, you know, with protesters. And I'm not making this, I don't think this is necessarily the case, because there's a lot of evidence that there were some bearded men that were well-trained. But, like, I think it's possible, generally speaking, with protests, where police get too aggressive in crowd control, and then it does become violent on the protester side, you know? So, like, if you're getting sprayed with a fucking water cannon in the middle of winter, right, you're going to be a little pissed off about that.
This wasn't a Black Lives Matter protest. Like, this wasn't one of those things in New York City where there, you know, cops were hitting people with cars and stuff, and then people got rowdy. Like, this wasn't just like looting of like Target. This was fucking organized.
Yeah,
18 cops were killed. Like, there were no police officers killed in New York during the summer 2020.
People were getting murdered.
Like, people were dying. I think. Yeah. The entire toll of like the riots of 2020 was like 20 people, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm kind of making that up, but I know it wasn't in the hundreds. And that was an entire.
Some of them were of cops, rioting. Though, and some of them. I think the Jan 6 riots. So,
what's that?
Some of them, cops died in the Jan 6 riot.
Yeah, but the only cop that died of a cardiac arrest.
Right.
And it died because protesters beat him up. Like, the story was the new what the news reported on January 6th in America on our January 6th was that a police officer was beat to death with a fire extinguisher. That's what the news reported. Right. There was no truth to that. That did not happen whatsoever. That was made up. The guy unfortunately tragically died of a cardiac arrest, and they made it up. They're like, this person died, and it was just, you know, he said, she said. You know, taking things out of context, not reporters being like, ha ha, we got the right wingers, we can throw them in jail. And then they put that on the fucking
Post. But he did die. He did die.
And it's tragic and it's sad, but like, you know, that shit was overblown. Like, that wasn't a fucking riot. Like, that, I mean, yeah, it was a riot, but it wasn't a fucking insurrection. This was a fucking insurrection. This was a real insurrection. This was a real aggressive, fucking organized, chaotic, violent, takeover of the government that did not
either that or the Jan 6 riot was just a really bad insurrection.
Maybe January 6th was just an awful insurrection.
They just did it wrong.
Like, listen, man, I think it was retarded what those people did, but of course. Come on. Like, let's just be real. There's, like, let's compare the differences between a real violent
insurrection
and, mm-hmm. you know, or, I mean, is it an insurrection when it's foreign fighters? I guess that's like, another thing.
That's
or
a
is that
bigger
just,
question.
Yeah.
But we don't even know if it was foreign fighters or not either. We're taking that based on, you know, the reporting of some random Euractiv person. Like, what the fuck do they know? You know, like, I haven't
seen. Yeah, and they're based out of Brussels, so.
Yeah, but, so you know, we don't know. We have no idea.
But yeah, so this is, things get interesting too. So they try to break into the studios of TV channel MIR, and then the rioters told journalists of MIR, and I'm having trouble understanding this, that they wanted to air a message, but were told that that wasn't possible because the button for broadcasting is in Moscow. So I didn't really get that. I think there's a translation issue. Sorry, the button for broadcasting is in Moscow. Like, the button to turn on the cameras for broadcast is in Russia. That doesn't really make that much sense to me, unless that just the literal interpretation that, like, they literally
Hey, I'm sorry, man. The button for broadcasting is in Moscow.
You can't turn on the camera. It's in Moscow.
Sorry. That's funny.
Maybe it is. Like, does the Kremlin have that much control over their media?
Maybe.
So the rioters reportedly said, record us and you will air it later. But it is still not known what their message was.
Fuck, man.
And on January 7th, rioters tried to get hold of the TV tower, and a heavy exchange of fire was heard for 12 hours until 9 o'clock, but they were not successful. Apparently, taking control of the TV could see TV and radio transmissions covering half the country's territory cut off. With the absence of internet the morning of January 5th, this would mean a complete blackout for the population. It could spark mass panic.
Right. This also makes it super hard for us to know exactly what's going on here. Like, I want to watch that video. You know, what was that video? What do they look like?
Yeah.
What are they saying? You know, like, what do they want? And we don't have that right now. And also, there was, like, no internet for a minute. And no internet means very little information coming out of the ground, right? So no TikTok videos, no fucking tweets, no nothing, you know, like, nothing. And it's super similar to the Tigray crisis when we're covering that one. It's just like, well, we have to try and use these mainstream outlets and hope that they're not totally bullshit, right? But understand that a lot of it might be. You know, it just kind of makes it hard to understand. But things that we do know, you know, are the official, like, press releases and official statements and things like that from the people. And I want to talk a little bit about Tokayev's interpretation of what's going on here. I know that a bit of this was in your draft of our notes initially on this topic, and it really got me thinking. And I think we can have a little discussion about it. Do you want to read that bit that I pulled from the old notes?
Where it says Tokayev's interpretation?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, so his interpretation is that it was a coup attempt with the participation of terrorists who came from abroad with combat experience from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. In his view, the protests were hijacked from January 5th by according to him, 20,000 bandits. It is said that many of them had been paid $700 per month to be ready since November to December. All of them have been promised money and looting opportunities. So yeah, he's claiming that these guys have been planning on doing this for months now, and that they are all paid, and they're going to be paid in what they could steal.
And my question
that's like
is
so just Game of Thrones ish, like like you'll be paid in on your plunder.
Right. I mean, but paid by who? Because they were getting $700 a month, right? And how does he have this information? And, you know, I can totally see that the possibility of these protests being hijacked because of the evidence that we showed, right? A bunch of people showed up. They were pissed off about gas and other things. They got what they wanted. Looked like it was going better. And then suddenly we see these bearded militants come over and take control and start fucking chopping heads off, allegedly, right? I mean, that doesn't sound like a loosely organized protest against high gas prices and, like, political hierarchy. That sounds like a coordinated effort, right? But Tokayev is being super specific here, right, in what he's saying. And he's saying that they were ready since November and they were being paid $700 a month. I want to see that evidence before I consider this true. But until then, I feel like this is just government propaganda with maybe some confirmed fishy shit going on. But yeah, it's interesting because that's what he's saying. And that is what we can know because people write down what he said, you know?
Yeah, so. I agree. Like, that's coming from their intelligence agencies there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you really can't, you know, the government's never really the good guy. The government's always lying, you know, whether it be the U.S. government or whether it be the government of Kazakhstan. Right. So it's the state is always lying. So it's very difficult to parse out the truth. Like, we would have to go through like every fucking Twitter video that's available
yeah,
to really parse this out. And you know, we're probably not going to do that. No offense to us, but it takes a lot of time and we're not professional journalists. Now, I guess eyewitnesses are saying that they were very well organized. And, you know, according to Tokayev, you know, without the arrival of the CSTO forces, you know, these terrorists would have also attacked the presidential palace in Nur-Sultan. And, you know, there was this single coordination center. But he didn't really say where it was located and who was behind it. So mm-hmm. It's very vague. Like, there was, right. Like, it's who did it.
Right.
And then there's three scenarios. You know, there's, the first one is the Yakim's razor. The Nazarbayev circle try to get rid of Tokayev. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the circle includes his family, his daughter, his nephews, the chief of secret services, Karim Masimov. And, you know, these people are all guilty of high treason. And, you know, this version doesn't have to exclude that the Nazarbayev circle was using the services of Islamist militants. Like, what's stopping them from just employing these leftover mercenaries from who are in northern Afghanistan at the time or who are in Syria? You know, we don't know where they really came from. You know, we're just getting that information that they were close to the border. They were in northern they could have been in northern Afghanistan. Maybe they were in Kyrgyzstan, and then they crossed the border. But again, it's hard to really parse that out. But what's stopping the government from just employing them? Like, do they need the CIA to make that connection? Do they need the help of Turkish intelligence to make that connection? Right. You know, obviously, the Turkish intelligence definitely has probably the best pipeline of those fighters. So maybe,
yeah,
you know, maybe this was purely a Turkish operation. But then, I guess the second version that has been circulating social media is that this was totally a color revolution, and this was instigated by the U.S. Mm-hmm. And its main impact or its main motivation is that it's a result of just the current tensions between Moscow and Washington over Ukraine. And you know, that theory is substantiated by arguing that Islamist militants were combating pro-Russian Assad in Syria. And then, you know, the third version is that, you know, the aftermath of the U.S. retreat from Afghanistan is that there is just an attempt to destabilize Central Asia using, you know, former Afghan militants.
I think, obviously, of the three, the first one is the most likely, right? And we've said this a few times already, but Nazarbayev has been in power for, like, the entire post-Soviet history of Kazakhstan. And, you know, even right up till Tokayev's announcement, you know, saying that Nazarbayev wouldn't be in charge of the Security Council, he was in charge of the Security Council the entire time, which, let's be honest here, if you're in charge of the military, you're in charge, you know? And he also had that, like, father of the nation type title too, you know? I think it's totally possible that the U.S. used Kazakhstan as a way to stick it to Russia with proxy forces, you know, like by proxy over Ukraine. But, like, in hindsight, the scale at which this color revolution would distract Russia from Ukraine or, like, hurt Russia in any meaningful way was super small, you know? So I don't really think... At least there's not enough evidence that I'm seeing to suggest that this was U.S.-led. Not enough evidence that I'm seeing that it was Turkish-led. There's a lot of people saying that it is, but that doesn't mean that that's evidence, you know? And just because maybe they might be interested in doing something like this, doing a color revolution, doesn't necessarily mean that they actually pulled the trigger on it. You know what I mean? There seems to be more evidence pointing to the fact that it was like an internal power structure struggle. And then the third one, like, I don't fully understand that third, like, route. Like, who's attempting to destabilize Asia, Central Asia? Like, the Taliban? The U.S.? And more importantly, why? Like, who benefits from it? I just can't see how
Follow the money.
Yeah, seriously. I can't see how the Taliban would benefit from it. They just ended a major war with the U.S. Why would they start one with Russia by fucking around in Central Asia, right? And I also can't see how the U.S. would benefit from it, given my response to the second option. I just, it doesn't seem like it's consequential enough to be worth the trouble, you know? So it could be the first one. I'd offer a fourth one. The fourth one would be it's a false flag from Tokayev to solidify power.
Hey, that would be the M. Night Shyamalan twist, right?
Yep. We'll see. We'll see how Tokayev makes it out of this particular thing. Maybe he did it to like appease the Russia and China, you know, parties, right? Maybe.
Well,
that's
what I saw in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. There was like kind of a hint that it seems like this could have been coordinated by Russia. It was like there was like some lines in some New York Times coverage of that.
I mean, if we're just spitballing here, you know,
yeah,
then we have to bring it up too, right? Like, it's totally possible that Tokayev was like, you know what, I'm going to consolidate power, and I'm going to make my neighbors very happy by doing so, right? And so he meets with Putin and he meets with Xi, and he's like, yo, you know, this dude Nursultan, you know, he's cozying up to the West and he has all this power in the Security Council. I'm gonna do some shit to make it look like he tried to, you know, do an insurrection. So I'm gonna do this false flag. We're gonna use these Salafist fighters. It's gonna be real nasty, right? And then you guys can come in, flex your muscle about how awesome you are, you know, Russia, and you're gonna come in, swoop and save the day, in and out real quick. So that'll make you look like a gangster, and it'll promote your power. And China, I'm already friends with you. I speak Chinese, you know? So you can go ahead and keep doing your Belt and Road Initiative right after I have, you know, consolidated power. That's a possibility. But like, me just spitting bullshit like this, like, all of these options are just bullshit until we get more information, you know?
Yeah.
And the one that we have the most information about is the first one, which is just that it's an internal power struggle.
Yeah. I'm on the same page as you. Now I have a good segue because we're talking about false flags.
Okay.
So, you know, you hear that the White House has been claiming that Russia has been planning a false flag right now to invade Ukraine. So,
right.
So some major stories came out with between Russia and Ukraine, and man, it certainly seems that it's really at its height right now. It's getting very nerve-wracking to see this continue to go on, this gamesmanship that also has the potential to become very deadly if there were some type of military conflict between the United States and Russia, because Russia at this point has been saying they're not fucking around anymore. They've drawn some very clear lines, and the United States has just been saying, no, we're not doing this. And, you know, those lines are, Russia wants the United States to put in paper that they're going to stop trying to get Ukraine into NATO. And then the U.S. says no. But it's funny because it's like, Ukraine's not going to join NATO anyway. So why not just put it in the paper?
I mean, like, they've been trying to do it since
2008.
They
want to have this pipe dream for them.
Right.
Like, they're going to join, that they're going to be part of NATO. But, you know, the other NATO members don't even really want them in NATO. So I think it's just fucking crazy. And now Russia's saying, hey, all right, well, you know, we can throw our weight around. Like, listen, we can throw you know, weapons in Latin America. In Venezuela. Like, What are you going to stop us? How do you like it? How do you like it? What if we put weapons in Canada? They didn't say that, but you know they're saying that they put weapons in Venezuela, or they can put bases in Venezuela, which is a lot closer to us than Ukraine.
And they have a pretty good relationship with Venezuela too.
Yeah. So. Well, because they're both ostracized countries, and you're kind of forcing countries to, you know, we did an episode on Russia and China last week. And, you know, the reason, the number one reason why they're forced to cooperate is because they are ostracized so much. So you're kind of forced to band together when you're ostracized from the rest of the world. So you're kind of pushing these nations together, even though they don't really have that much in common, like culturally at least. And, you know, there wouldn't be this relationship with them. It's like the two weird kids in school. You know, they always end up finding each other and sitting at the same lunch table. That's kind of what it's like. The two weird kids are put together.
Well, at least you know, the kid Russia who eats
his boogers and the kid who fucking picks his nose. The kid who eats his boogers and the kid who, like, I don't know. I'm being just mean right now.
Who has a special list of names.
The kids
The Venezuela-Russia connection actually makes more sense, like, in terms of, like, an alliance or whether, you know, overt or covert. Because, as we were talking about with Russia-China, there's a lot of trouble with them creating an alliance. And it's primarily that, like, neither country would want to be this the junior partner in that relationship. Neither of them would want to concede in that respect. And also, even equality in a partnership like that might be troublesome as well. But Venezuela, Russia would definitely be the senior partner there, right? They definitely have more money. They definitely have more guns. They're definitely better in every respect by every measure. So why wouldn't Russia want to make that call? And it would benefit Venezuela because then they'd have somebody financially and militarily backing them up against the United States. So that is actually more likely than a Russia-China alliance. And then to your point, what happens if they start putting strategic bombers in Venezuela? What are we going to do about it? How are we going to like it?
I think that the United States may nuke Russia over that. Yeah. So I just want to get back to this. So there was a claim that Russia was planning a false flag attack, which was published by Natasha Bertrand. Now, Natasha Bertrand, she works for CNN. She's the same person that came out with the Russian bounty story, which was 99% chance, completely bullshit. Intelligence agencies even came out after that saying it was low confidence that that was true. So, you know, someone just feeds these reporters
with these conspiracy
just fucking
theories.
Whatever. Like, they're whatever they want them to report, they just feed them. They're like, okay, like, because they don't, there's very few, like, journalists anymore. There's like 10 of them in the world. There's really, like, there's like Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, Gareth Porter. Like, there's really not many journalists out there who, like, do investigative journalism. You know, there's a couple of people for BuzzFeed who are actually pretty good. There's a couple of people for Intercept who are good too, but it's like not, there's really few of them. And they especially do not work for CNN. So, you know, they get fed stories and they fucking report them without any kind of background, or they're just like, okay, I got my CIA contact. They're going to tell me the report that Russia's planning a false flag. I'll put that in the paper and be news. And, like, we know that's not true. Like, we know that's most likely complete horseshit. And then, you know, there is another story that came out that the CIA has been training Ukrainian paramilitary groups to, like, explicitly kill Russians. The Yahoo News just released a story on that. But, you know, we've known that all along that's been going on. You know, I call me a peacenik, but can't we just make a compromise as a country to say, hey, listen, why don't we just draw some lines and then we'll just respect people's sphere of influence? The United States, listen, we're going to have our sphere of influence over all of Western Europe, and we're actually going to have our sphere of influence over the northern, you know, Europe, the northern Soviet, ex-Soviet states. So Latvia and Lithuania, those states are going to be in our influence. Your sphere of influence can be in Central Asia and Ukraine and Eastern Europe and the Caucasus. Then China, your sphere of influence could be over North Korea and Taiwan. And then the U.S., our sphere of influence is going to be the rest of the world, like Japan, like Southeast Asia, you know, all of the Western Hemisphere, like, that's our sphere of influence. Like, that sounds like a pretty good deal. And I think that you can
pretty
work
good deal
that
for
out.
The U.S. because we get like more of it.
Yeah, like, you get such a bit larger chunk of the world, and it's not really capitulating that much. And Russia and China, you know, if there was a war with there, that probably would be the time where China would invade Taiwan if they were. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if they can logistically do it that quickly to subsequently do it when Russia would potentially invade Ukraine. But that's what at least all the experts are saying, right?
Yeah, well, that's what they're trying to say might happen. But we've done so many episodes on Taiwan, we'd see it coming.
Yeah.
It'd be very hard not to notice that they're about to do that.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Well, just to go back, though, and I just want to talk about, like, the current political situation, I think, that Joe Biden is in. Because Joe Biden is, I have a different perspective on Joe Biden, I think, than a lot of people do. I think that he is, he's old and feeble, definitely. I don't think he's as out of it as people say he is, but he's definitely old and weak right now. And right now he's in like a political lose-lose type situation because he's going to get, over the past like couple of weeks, over the past, you know, couple of months, he's taken some major political hits. So, you know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, you know, that could have been a win, but it ended up being a loss because of, you know, mainly just the whole Afghan charade imploded in his presidency. Like, everything came, all the chickens came to roost in August of 2021 when the entire world, who may have not been paying attention to how big of a sham the Afghan war was, it just was shared with the world that we've been literally pumping trillions of dollars into a garbage can. Like, not to say Afghanistan's a garbage can, but I'm saying the point that we were throwing the money away, burning the money. Mm-hmm. People were stealing, like, it was just complete and utter bullshit. And that just imploded on them. And then to make things, to heighten the negative press, is that tragically there was a terrorist attack that killed 13 U.S. military personnel, 12 Marines, or I think 12 Marines and one naval officer. 13 Americans died during the evacuation. And obviously that's incredibly tragic. And, you know, I don't think if that doesn't happen, that may go off in history as the most unbelievable airlift of all time.
Right.
As far as what they did with one landing strip. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, when you really have to go back and you look that they were able to...
because they gave up the
evacuate
other airport,
so many people with one landing strip, with one piece of pavement.
And pretty, like, damn good job. I mean, all,
like, Jesus, like, what it, like, that, like, it really shows you what the U.S. military is capable of. The fact that they are logistically able to evacuate that many people. Now the story is why is there one landing strip? Like, why is there one?
Right.
Like, that's the exactly. that's the scandal, but. You know, it was pretty amazing what the U.S. military was able to achieve, evacuating that many people. You know, I think maybe that if that doesn't look, if that's not such a horrible image, and if the Biden administration wasn't saying how, you know, the Afghan forces were going to be able to oppose the Taliban for at least like a couple of months. No, that doesn't go down. You know, if that country collapses in a whimper rather than on the national spotlight, it probably doesn't look as bad on Biden's approval, because that's when Biden's approval went from the positive to the negatives. And then a bunch of things have added on that now. The fact that he's not going to get Build Back Better in, his COVID mandates have been blocked by the Supreme Court. His approval rating right now from a Quinnipiac poll was... like 33%, which is very low, which is incredibly low. So now we're dealing in a situation where Biden, I don't think he necessarily wants to escalate tensions. He himself, I think Biden has made a lot of mistakes in his career in foreign policy, and he's been burnt so much by experience. And when I say burnt by experience, his own son, the war that he was the whip for, the Iraq War II, dies from cancer because he's stationed at a burn pit. His good son dies of cancer because he's stationed near a burn pit. A war that he really was a key seller of that war. He's the whip who got the Democrats to basically vote for that war. And he lost his son doing that. Ever since then, he became a lot more tepid on foreign policy as far as being a lot more rational. And I think he's seen so many mistakes as far as like funding, Salafist groups in Syria and escalating tension. So he didn't agree with Libya. This is a guy who's been burnt so much that I don't think he really wants to get in any type of international crisis at all. But he makes the claim that the U.S. will not go to war with Russia over Ukraine. He basically said it's not worth American lives, which is good. But you know that the corporate press are the real warmongers, and they're going to hold his feet to the fire and not let them make any type of compromise as far as with Russia, because it will be political suicide. And it's not that Americans would care if the U.S. made compromises with Russia. No American would care.
Americans would care, but they don't.
Very few Americans give a flying crap about what's going on in Ukraine. There's like 200 people in America who care about that. There's very few. But the corporate press will just be like, all right, well, if he's not going to give us what we want in Ukraine and Russia, we're just going to hammer him on other stuff that he's failing on. Right. So I think he's in that political situation where there's not really any good options. And Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan are nincompoops. They're just nincompoops. They're just like weak, neoliberal, established, not impressive people. So they're kind of boxed into being, to not making a compromise with them, even though the stakes are just so unbelievably high. So I guess we'll see what happens. I think the U.S. will probably have to cave or find a way to keep the status quo going. It's going to be difficult.
I mean, my bit on this is that I think you're absolutely right on like everything you said about Biden. And I think that, in my opinion, I think the U.S. needed somebody or needs somebody like Biden who has been burned like that can exercise a more sober, foreign policy, because I actually think that he's doing the right thing here. I think it was the right thing to continue the pull out of Afghanistan, 100%. Did he fuck it up? Yes. But like, do it? Yes. And he should get the credit for that. Keep doing it, sticking by it, despite the fact that his entire party was trying to make it different. And on Ukraine, I think he's absolutely right, being like, nope, not touching that. We're not going to war over that. Fuck that. That's absolutely 100% the correct thing to say. And maybe he ends up being a one-term president over this, but in my opinion, he was exactly, I think, what we needed in this moment. We needed a rational, sober, like somebody who's seen some shit to be like, nope, we're not doing that.
Well, here's the thing. I like the fact that he's feeble and weak. I like having a feeble and weak president.
Yeah.
I kind of find the appeal in that. I think a lot of times the White House is less hawkish than its special interest groups and a lot of the weird foreign policy. Because the people who get into foreign policy and work at think tanks and who are advising people, they're weirdos. They're weirdos whose life depends on, their career depends on having these like complicated relationships with other countries. So that's their incentive to keep these complicated relationships complicated. But the people in the White House, the people who are elected, they have to face the consequences, especially the president. They have to face the consequences when things go wrong. So, I think they're typically more sober-minded than the people who are advising them. And then, the corporate press is just is completely inhabited by, these weirdo think tank monsters that, want to push the U.S. and Russia into a very dangerous situation. And that dangerous situation isn't like this is not, I'm not being hyperbolic, that dangerous situation is a nuclear war. Like, what, how on earth is fighting Russia in a nuclear war over Ukraine, which is like, what do we want? Their agriculture? Like, what is this? We want their, the breadbasket of Europe or something? Like, what, why the hell do we care? And you may say, like, hey, man, if you're Ukrainian and you hate Russian influence in your country and Russian influence is keeping Ukraine from developing into the Western world, well, you know, I hate to tell you, but I don't care enough for the world to risk nuclear war. Like, it's just, I personally just don't care enough. Like, yeah, I mean, good luck to you. I hope you shed them. I hope you shed the influence out. But it's just not worth going to escalating such the play this game at such high stakes.
Yeah, I mean, I hear
that's,
that.
That's my rant. Yeah. So I'll spare you any more of that.
I think I'm with you on that, man, to be honest. You know, my heart does bleed for the people, but, you know, they got to find out ways to do it internally on their own. That country's government, that state needs to find a way to provide for their people a more lucrative option than Russian involvement or U.S. military aid.
Yeah, I think a former intelligence guy from Ukraine just came out and said, like, what the hell's going on right now? Like, Ukraine is just becoming a depot for weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a former, I forget his title, but he's like, Ukraine just becoming like a depot for weapons. Like, this is not going to work out well. I don't know. I think this could get dangerous, but I guess we will see. I think, you know, no one really knows what's going to happen. Like, all the experts are like, we don't really know what's going to go. it's like not, no one can really interpret what
it's unknowable
what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. Hopefully we'll be living to watch and do another episode of Bro History next week.
And there's not a nuclear war in between.
You're safer than I am. You got out. I'm in the hot spot. They're not going to take out Puerto Rico.
Yeah, they're not hitting San
Juan. We have a new host.
It's going to turn into a liberal podcast after you're gone.
After Henry died in a nuclear bomb.
Time for me make you all join Antifa.
This is going to be now we're an Antifa network.
Yeah.
Antifa San Juan.
That's funny.
All right. You want to end this thing?
Yeah, man.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of Bro History. If you want to support the show, you can rate and review the podcast, rate us on iTunes. And if you're listening on Spotify, make sure you rate us on Spotify because it's a new feature where you can rate the podcast on your Spotify app. So do that. It helps us grow, and we really do appreciate it. And most of all, we appreciate you giving us time every single week to listen to us talk about things that, you know, we're not really qualified to talk about, but we do it anyway. And then you can also join us on Patreon if you want to, you know, join our Slack community. It's another way to support our show. It's our Patreon. And is there anything else that we should add before we wrap this one up?
No, man. I think that's about it.
All right. I think this was a good episode. All right, guys. See you next week.
Peace.
Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.